Now, shall we begin?
So when I sent my people to kill your people for killing my people, you killed more of my people. Not cool. Not f***ing cool. You have no f***ing idea how not f***ing cool that f***ing is. But I think you're going to be up to speed here shortly. You are so gonna regret crossing me in a few minutes. Yeah, you are. You see, Rick, whatever you do, no matter f***ing what, you do not mess with the New World Order. The New World Order is this, and it's really very simple. Even if you're f***ing stupid, which you very well may be, you can understand it. You ready? Here goes. Pay attention. Give me your sh**, or I will kill you. You work for me now. You have sh**. You give it to me. That's your job. Now, I know that is a mighty big, nasty pill to swallow. But swallow it? You most certainly f***ing will. You ruled the roost. You built something. You thought you were safe. I get it. But the word is out. You are not safe, not even f***ing close. In fact, you are more f***ed if you don't give me what I want. And what I want is half your shit. If that's too much, then you can go make, find, or steal more, and it'll even out sooner or later. This is your way of life now. The more you fight back, the harder it will be.
Every election is a struggle over control of Negan's bat. I will admit that I'm not that conversant with the storyline, let alone the deep lore of The Walking Dead. I do know enough, however, to understand that Negan is arguably the most compelling personification of the evil abstraction that we call the state in contemporary popular literature, if we use that term to encompass such things as graphic novels and comic books and primetime television. As the figure who claims a territorial monopoly on violence and exercises a proprietary claim on all goods and labor within his self-proclaimed realm, Negan is the distilled essence of what statists call civilization. The chief protagonist in The Walking Dead, a former law enforcement officer named Rick Grimes, leads a small and very embattled community of luridly imperfect survivors in a post-apocalyptic setting. They've assembled something of a voluntarist community. The countryside is inhabited by creatures called walkers, I believe the appropriate term in popular parlance is zombies. They can infect the embattled human survivors by biting them. Rick and his followers find themselves in their quest for survival, engaged in a low-intensity conflict with the more feral band of survivors who call themselves the Saviors, and they operate as Negan's deputies in collecting half of the food and other resources they can find within their claimed territory. When the survivors try to extract their supposed share from Rick's band, they meet with lethal resistance, and I should point out that from what little I know, it appears that Rick and his friends were not entirely guiltless. They apparently tried to launch a preemptive strike against the Saviors, which is never a good idea, either morally or practically. Negan dispatches other enforcers to punish Rick and his friends for their resistance, and Rick and his friends, in a display of defensive force, kill them as well. Then a series of plot developments ensue, with which I'm not terribly familiar, once again, in the spirit of full disclosure. And Rick and his people are captured by Negan and surrounded by armed Saviors, forced to their knees, and left helpless as Negan explains that one of them is going to be killed as an exemplary punishment for the others. As King Henry said at the gates of Harfleur, at least as Shakespeare depicted that event, Rick and his friends had been found guilty in defense, and the price to be paid was to watch as one of them, once again to paraphrase Shakespeare, had his brains dashed out through the instrumentality of Negan's bat, an implement wrapped in barbed wire. And I'm reminded of the aphorism that the police are to the state as the edge is to the blade. The police are to the state as the bat is to Negan. This is what medieval defenders of the horrible principle called the divine right of kings call the ultima ratio regis, that is to say, the last or final argument of the king. That motto is often etched into artillery, and I think it would make a very suitable inscription for Negan's bat. I'm reminded, of course, of that very familiar passage from one of my favorite works of literature, St. Augustine, The City of God, Chapter 4, Book 4, in which he related the parable of the emperor and the pirate, two very violent men who were in the same racket. One of them was much more successful, that would be the emperor. His instrumentality of coercion and extraction was far greater, and his plundered resources were far deeper, but he was in the same business as the pirate. And Augustine reflected upon this by saying, justice being taken away, after all, what are kingdoms but vast robberies? A gang, he wrote, is a group of men under the command of a leader, bound by a compact of association in which the plunder is divided according to an agreed convention. If this villainy wins so many recruits from the ranks of the demoralized that it acquires territory, establishes a base, captures cities, and subdues peoples, it then openly arrogates to itself the title of kingdom, which is conferred on it in the eyes of the world, not by the renouncing of aggression, but by the attainment of impunity. Negan created a government. He had impunity. He could do what he wished upon anybody who found himself within the realm claimed by himself and his clique, the Saviors. Americans who cast a presidential ballot in this year's election, and many of them have already begun, so eager are they to choose a master. They're deciding which of the two extravagantly pathological personalities on offer will wield Negan's bat. Their desire is to be among the who rather than the whom. They want to be those who are standing at the periphery while the other party is made prostrate on their knees as the ruler who presumes to own them decides what, if anything, they will be allowed to keep, not only of their property, but of their lives. And I will have a great deal more to say on this theme when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio and the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
You answer to me. You provide for me. You belong to me. Right?
Speak what you're spoken to! You answer to me. You provide for me.
Provide for you.
You belong to me. Right!
Right.
Right. That is the look I wanted to see.
You. I know he said some mean things about Rand, but Rand said some things back to him. I would love to see both men friends. I know they played golf, but all that aside, is there any way that you could be given, say, a list of his policies that are on his site and say, I don't fully endorse Trump, like Senator Sessions and others do, but, and Sessions said he's not perfect, but the system hates him. He's a populist. He wants better deals for us. He's an anti-globalist. The CFR hates him. I mean, it would just be so wonderful to see a purist, you know, Dr. No, a guy with a perfect constitutional record like yourself. I understand you don't want to now endorse him because you've got a perfect record, something nobody else has. But is there any way to at least highlight the things you think are good? Because I would love to see, the whole Ron Paul libertarian revolution somehow, at least talking to the Trump populist movement.
Well, I think he's too much all over the place. So I have no idea what he believes in. I don't believe he has a basic libertarian principle, but his economic policies are all over the place. When you talk about a 35% tax on imports, you're looking for a trade war. Trade wars lead to bad wars. So, no, I think personally he's very much of an authoritarian. I'm not looking for a boss. I'm looking for somebody who will leave me alone, and he hasn't convinced me that he'll leave me alone. I think he will be the champion of the executive order.
Voting is usually described as a civic duty, just as taxation is perversely referred to as the price we pay for a civilized society. Whenever you hear that cliche, think of Negan and his bat. He was the civilizing agent in this post-apocalyptic horrorscape depicted in The Walking Dead. Taxation is actually the process through which violent parasites, once again think of Negan and the Saviors, acquire the material means to conduct their assault on everything that makes civilization possible, beginning, of course, with the sanctity of property rights and the peaceful exchange through mutually beneficial commerce of goods and services. This is subverted through taxation. Every tax is an act of theft and a net derogation from actual civilized society. It is the incremental theft of human lives, buttressed with the implicit threat of 100% taxation in the form of the summary execution of those who resist. Voting is best seen, I think, as an act of participatory larceny, in which the guilty parties actually steal from themselves because they're choosing a master. This brings me to the unpleasant subject of somebody I greatly admire writing something that is profoundly stupid and morally offensive. I'm referring to Dr. Walter Block of the group styling itself Libertarians for Trump, making the case for choosing a more lenient slave master. Libertarianism is nothing if not the repudiation of the idea of slavery and the assertion of self-ownership. If you abandon that premise, you're no longer speaking as a libertarian. This is, to use an expression that has become a favorite of apologists for Trump, this is a binary proposition. It's either or. You either assert your self-ownership or you embrace slavery. To do the former is to act as a libertarian. To do the latter is to embrace servitude. Suppose, writes Dr. Block, we were all slaves and the master said we could have a democratic election. We could vote for Overseer Batty, who would whip us unmercifully once per day, or Overseer Goody, who would do exactly the same thing but only once per month. We all voted for the latter. Is this incompatible with libertarianism? Would this make us worse libertarians? Anyone who thinks so does not really understand this philosophy. Libertarianism, digested into two propositions, is the principle of self-ownership and the principle of non-aggression. If you don't embrace and practice those two principles, whatever it is you're promoting cannot honestly be called libertarianism. When I read this a few months ago, I was irresistibly reminded of one of my favorite epigrams from Edward Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. A nation of slaves is always prepared to applaud the clemency of their master, who, in the abuse of absolute power, does not proceed to the last extremes of injustice and oppression. Think once again of Negan. He demanded half of Rick's. He was mercifully granting him the half that remained. He offered to kill one member of Rick's community. Actually, I suppose this is a spoiler of sorts. In the televised version of this scene, he killed two of them because this was supposedly a proportionate price to be extracted for Rick and his community seeking to defend themselves against the pervasive aggression and the feral violence of the saviors. Presumably, living under Negan's rule would be more agreeable than facing the hazards of living among the walkers. I don't think that the author of The Walking Dead had Hobbes in mind, but this is clearly a Hobbesian proposition. Within the domain claimed by Negan and the saviors, there was some material and physical protection against the chaotic violence that prevails elsewhere. Out there, of course, lives are solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, but here, through the exercise and the frequent demonstration of lethal force and violence, there is an order to be maintained in which some semblance of physical security can be enjoyed. What Walter Block is offering by way of an apologia for Donald Trump is a variant on the Hobbesian proposition. The Leviathan state is simply accepted as a non-negotiable reality. Our status as slaves within the Leviathan state is likewise accepted as an incontestable aspect of reality. And we're left with a patently false dichotomy. You can have overseer baddie or overseer goody. Both of them will exercise plenary control over your life. But on the basis of what we believe about overseer goody, we can expect that he will be at least somewhat more measured, somewhat more lenient in inflicting upon us violence that we have done nothing to merit. Now, how do we know this, or how do we pretend to know this about the character described as overseer goody? He professes to be somebody motivated by good intentions. He's supposedly a patriot and somebody who's less ambitious with respect to the purposes to which he would put his unaccountable power. As I contemplated Dr. Block's defense of Trump, I was reminded of another quote from somebody I generally don't respect very much, and that's Daniel Webster. Daniel Webster, of course, was an arch-unionist. During the War of 1812, he said some remarkably clear-headed things about the evil of conscription. On another occasion, he offered this insight. Good intentions will always be pleaded for every assumption of authority. It is hardly too strong to say that the Constitution, that, by the way, is a document of which Donald Trump's ignorance is all-encompassing, and the same can be said of the contempt that Hillary Clinton has for that document. It is hardly too strong to say that the Constitution was made to guard the people against the dangers of good intentions. There are men in all ages who mean to govern well, but they mean to govern. They promise to be good masters, but they mean to be masters. Now, when even an arch-unionist an estatist of sorts, like Daniel Webster, understands that Americans cannot accept the proposition that a good master should be allowed to rule them. What excuse does Dr. Walter Block or any of the other putative libertarians for Trump have for saying that libertarians have a moral duty to vote for a slave overseer? I'll be back in just a minute.
Israelites came out of Egypt, they had accepted God as their king, and that's what they lived by. They did not have a king. What they had were judges. But there were always going to be arguments and conflicts, so these conflicts were taken not to the government, but to somebody that was chosen to be a judge and a respected person that respected the law and respected their traditions. A time came, there was always temptation, even as the Israelites were leaving Egypt, that there was the temptation to drift away from the belief in God. People came and said, you know, we want somebody to take care of us. We want a king. And Samuel strongly objected to it. He explained to him, you do not want a king. That will substitute for God.
We all feel the same way. We always have for years. So we finally have this God that's going to come down and help us all.
You just referred to Trump as a God.
Yeah, he is. Well, like she said, Jesus, then Trump.
Pastor, don't you want a candidate who embodies the teaching of Jesus and would govern this country according to the principles found in the Sermon on the Mount? The interviewer asked Robert Jeffress, a Baptist pastor with a congregation of 12,000 people. Heck no, he replied. I would run from that candidate as far as possible, because the Sermon on the Mount was not given as a governing principle for this nation. Pastor Jeffress is a representative of that peculiar but growing sect of people who want not a separation between church and state, but a separation between faith and state. They have no problem at all with the prospect of the ecclesial and secular powers commingling, as long as the Christian faith isn't involved in that proposition. Jeffress, pastor at the First Baptist Church in Dallas, declared that if Jesus were running for office against Trump, he would vote for Trump. Government is to be a strong man to protect its citizens against evildoers. When I'm looking for somebody who's strong to deal with ISIS and exterminate ISIS, I don't care about that candidate's tone or vocabulary. I want the meanest, toughest son of a you-know-what I can find, and I believe that's biblical, quoth the learned pastor, as he expressed the fundamental Christian heresy. I grant that not everybody who listens to this podcast shares my Christian faith. The one thing that defines a Christian is the recognition that only one being in the universe has a right to rule, and that's Jesus Christ. When you say that Jesus is Lord, you're saying that he is Lord over everything in your life, and that Caesar really has no claim upon you. That's, I believe, the true meaning of the famous parable in which he said, give to Caesar that which is Caesar's. Caesar gets nothing. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. You have been bought with a price. Be ye not then the servants of men. What Pastor Jeffress is doing, in my opinion, and he is entirely typical of a number of self-described evangelical leaders who have gone whoring after Donald Trump, he is making exactly the same mistake that the Jews of Jesus' time made in expecting a Messiah who would be a temporal ruler, somebody who would exercise coercive power on behalf of an embattled tribe and an embattled nation. The biggest difference here is that the United States of America is not a conquered province of a globe-spanning empire. The United States of America is a globe-spanning empire, and these are people who are afraid that the United States government will be knocked from the pinnacle it presently occupies. You see, they've been shown the nations and kingdoms and principalities of the world in a vision. And unlike Jesus when he was given that temptation on the Mount, these people who dare to profess his name are saying that they want to cling to that power, and they're willing essentially to repudiate their worship of Christ, their allegiance to Christ. To declare somebody one's liege is to recognize that person as your Lord. And to be a Christian is to say, Jesus is Lord, he is my liege, and uniquely so. They're willing to repudiate that allegiance in order to elevate somebody who is a vile, vulgar, concupiscent, materialistic, authoritarian pig of a human being, because he exemplifies power. In their eyes, writes Professor Roger O. Friedland, he's a professor of religious studies at UC Santa Barbara, in their eyes, America is now locked in a cosmic battle against evil, an apocalyptic war. On the inside, there are secularists like Killery, who allow women to take the lives of the ensouled through abortion. That, by the way, is something that Donald Trump has supported for probably at least 35 of his 70 years on this planet. His recent statements to the contrary notwithstanding, this is somebody who has described himself consistently as pro-choice with respect to abortion, and who has been a supporter of Planned Parenthood, and who violate the sanctity of marriage by providing access to that sacrament to gays and lesbians. Donald Trump is not opposed to this peculiar institution called same-sex marriage, and he, of course, is perhaps uniquely unqualified to be a defender of the sanctity of marriage. On the outside, there is the rise of political Islam, before which American geopolitics have been relatively ineffective. Trump is racializing the American nation, contends Professor Friedland. But conservative evangelicals are not white nationalists. They are Christian nationalists, that is to say, they are Christian-flavored nationalists. It is their nationalism, not their Christianity, that defines them. Only as people chosen by God can America stand strong. A majority of Republican voters subscribe to the view that Islam is fundamentally contradictory to Western values. For old guard conservative Christians, there is not a contradiction, there is a war. Islam is at war with us. We've witnessed its evil face, Billy Graham's son Franklin tweeted in response to the Paris attack in 2015 in opposition to Pope Francis. And it is Trump who calls out the struggle not only as a war against terror, but against Islam, who claimed, lying as he did so, I interject, that thousands of New Jersey Muslims cheered the 9/11 bombings, who hammers on violence and exile experienced by Christians in the Muslim world, who had banned Muslim immigration, and it is Trump who, since it started in 2011, led the charge that President Obama is not only foreign-born, but himself a Muslim. I don't believe that Barack Obama is any part of a Muslim. He's not a Kenyan Muslim. He's a Keynesian Marxist. Isn't that bad enough? Why do you have to paint the lily in reverse, as it were? With Obama's election, continues Professor Friedland, the enemy had made it not only inside the national gates, but inside the hearts of a naive and vulnerable American populace. Trump has committed himself to empower his politically mobilized evangelical base. Not only has he vowed to appoint anti-abortion judges to the court, and I would take those vows as seriously as he took his wedding vows. This is a person who has never kept an inconvenient promise in his life, and inconvenient promises are the only ones worth keeping. Not only has he vowed to appoint anti-abortion judges to the court, he has promised to build their political muscle by overturning IRS regulations forbidding partisan endorsements as a condition of their tax exemption. These are palace prophets who are seeking the favor of the state. What matters to them is their political power, not the power that can be exercised through them by teaching the plain and unadorned gospel of Jesus Christ. What they really want is political power. The Washington Post reported on Trump's high-level powwow with the evangelical leadership. Trump emphasized that America was hurting due to what he described as Christianity's slide to become, quote, weaker, weaker, weaker. He'd get department store employees to say Merry Christmas again and would fight restrictions on public employees, such as school coaches, from being allowed to lead sectarian prayer on the field. By what means he would compel people to say Merry Christmas, Trump did not specify. He's not in the business of specifics. He's in the business of gulling the gullible. In a war, one does not need a God who forgives and loves, but one like the God of the Israelites who fights and vanquishes, who delivers his people to a premillennial greatness. To be blunt, opined Ken Crow, former Tea Party head, America needs a hard-charging, outspoken, politically incorrect, borderline jerk at the moment. We need someone who loves our nation, makes our enemies quiver in fear. I believe that Donald Trump would leave them convulsed in laughter. But the point is, they're making exactly the same error that God's people made when the Messiah was walking among them, and he wasn't the guy they were looking for. I'll be back in a minute.
My point is if another country does to us what we do others, we're not going to like it very much. So I would say that maybe we ought to consider a golden rule in foreign policy. Don't do to other nations what we don't want to have them do to us. So we endlessly bomb these countries, and then we wonder why they get upset with us.
Back 10 times as hard. I really believe that. Somebody said, well, what would you do? What can you do? So easy. I drop a 25% tax on China. And you know, I said to somebody that is really the messenger. The messenger is important. I could have one man say, we're going to tax you 25%. And I could say another, listen, you mother, we're going to tax you 25%. Now, you said the same exact thing. You said the same exact thing, but it's a different message.
At the Republican convention, continues Professor Friedland in this remarkable essay, the crowds did not chant, yes, we can. They rather shouted, yes, you will. Trump is the leader who will make America strong and impenetrable, the powerful son of a powerful father, continues this essay. His campaign is organized around his person, not around core ideas or policy proposals. Like a myth or a wrestling match, it is the feelings he evokes that count. The feeling of humiliation, the feeling of threat, the feeling of imminent, even apocalyptic danger, that enemies outside and inside are coming to tear us apart, and the feelings of fierce determination and anger that they will not get away with it. I find that tremendously insightful, and of course I do, because I made the same point late last year. Obviously the man is brilliant, he agrees with me. That's something of a conceit, I grant. Hillary Clinton is cast as the handmaiden of our enemies. On the one side, an avatar of globalism, a woman in a pantsuit who has lived off the money of foreign nations who feed the coffers of the Clinton Foundation, which, by the way, is an exact description of who and what she is. If you are keyed into the plotline of Left Behind, the highest-selling drama on apocalyptic tribulations, Hillary stands in as a female antichrist whose global talk heralds the end times. Here's the interesting thing about the book of Revelation and its description of the Antichrist, and Matthew 24 and its talk of the apocalypse and the rise of incarnate evil. The Antichrist has to be somebody who deceives the very elect. He has to be somebody who takes in the faithful. That isn't a description of Barack Obama. That isn't a description of Hillary Clinton. That may be a description of Donald Trump. Take that for whatever little it may be worth. A large percentage of the evangelical voters are voting for Trump because they are against Clinton. He is not her. But this is not just an ordinary sexism, a preference for men over women. By the way, I don't have any use for the term sexism. I just put that out there by way of full disclosure. It is an affirmation of political patriarchalism. Trump is a powerful father who, while he fornicates with whom he likes, will protect the homeland, not a mother who endures a president husband who allows a lowly intern to fellate him in the Oval Office and makes deals with the Iranian mullahs. Opposition to Hillary has cosmic meaning, a desire to reinstall government authority based on the original order of things, a nation pleasing to God. Trump's vaunted old-school machismo qualifies him for office, and that machismo is just as phony as anything else about the man. It will enable him to take down Hillary and ISIS. Trump's seemingly unhinged jump in the second debate from his apology for locker room talk, it wasn't mere locker room talk, it was blithe and reflexive confession of sexually predatory behavior involving battery on unwilling women. It's really interesting. Trumpian serial adulterer Newt Gingrich accused Megyn Kelly, not my favorite news personality, of being obsessed with sex. In her limited defense, it's not the sex that offended her. It was the assault. You see, this is not merely somebody who's behaving like a hormonally preoccupied teenager. This is somebody who would inflict sexual violence upon women, transgressing their property rights in the most intimate way possible. That's the part that's offensive. Trump's seemingly unhinged jump in the second debate from his apology for, quote, locker room talk, to his capacity to protect the American body politic from the real predations of ISIS and immigration, signaled to his followers that the same masculine power that led to the excesses of the first would power the needed response to the second. So the proposition here is that we will allow Donald Trump to grope and otherwise sexually batter women, because otherwise we will be overrun with savagely bearded, dusky-skinned foreigners who would do the same thing, supposedly. So it's better to have a ruler invested with plenary power do those things rather than have foreigners come in and usurp that role, presumably. And women will have respect for me, he said, and I will tell you that I'm going to make our country safe. We're going to have borders in our country which we don't have now. His intrusion into Hillary's speaking space, hovering there as she took her turn, was not rude. It was an assertion of masculine primacy. Only men like him can stand strong, ready to move at the border. Trump's business enterprises exemplify power's role, Friedland continues. Real estate, the core of his holdings, is a fixed territory whose capitalization depends on the ability to secure the support of the state, on roads, zoning, tax abatements, subsidies. Real estate is about power, and the rents that accrue to that power as much as it is about markets. Trump is no market liberal, Friedland continues, so he would naturally use the state's power to countermand the property rights of corporations who export their jobs and plants abroad. He attributes his own market failures to his lack of power. That's a very useful insight. Trump does not understand the free market because he's never been part of the free market. He is the archetypal crony capitalist, the man of system referred to by Adam Smith. He's prospered through political connections, through rent-seeking, through confiscation of property through eminent domain, which he considers to be wonderful. And he hymns the praises of it in terms that Bernie Sanders would consider excessive. Bernie Sanders is actually to the right of Donald Trump on eminent domain. Bernie Sanders condemned the Kelo decision. Donald Trump celebrated it. He has only run one public company, Trump Hotels and Casino Resorts, in Atlantic City between 1995 and 2009. This is very important. Subject to stockholders and a board of directors, Trump was a disaster. Trump doesn't understand how business works. He calls himself a negotiator. That's a word that is close kindred to the Spanish term for business, which is negocios. It's a process in which mutual benefits are derived. Trump approaches business as if there's always a definitive winner and a definitive loser. It's a zero-sum proposition to him, because the free market is terra incognita to this crony capitalist. And when he had to exercise influence in collaborative fashion, in something that was akin to a genuine free market enterprise, he failed spectacularly, losing an aggregate amount very close to $1 billion. This is not a businessman. This is a crony capitalist politician, not an elective politician, but he's been a politician for his entire adult life. Concludes Professor Friedland, Trump represents a return to the masculine principle as the ground of the order of creation, and most importantly, in the current circumstances, to the order of destruction, the capacity to kill and subordinate those who would do us harm, to smash the interest groups who hobble American policymaking and somehow convert their interests into America's, which is to say, Trump is uniquely suited to wield Nagin's bat. Trump is an action figure of our times. Actually, that's not true, but he does play one on TV, I will grant. Conservative Christian politics are likewise grounded in the divine exception, his power to make and take life outside any law, to enter in history against the enemies of Christ to save the day. Friedland is transposing two very different concepts. He's describing the Nietzschean view of power, as best expressed, I think, in Raskolnikov's Conceit and Crime and Punishment, in which Dostoevsky used that figure to talk about people who believe that they were transcended and not beholden to natural law. Trump is not running to be a god, but a king chosen by a chosen people, a people long in exile, awaiting the man who can defeat their enemies and deliver them to greatness. And again, I'm reminded of the situation that prevailed among God's people at the time of Jesus' mortal advent. And this, by the way, this closing line of this essay, once again, is a perfect description of an Antichrist, not the definite article Antichrist, but somebody who is the exact opposite of the Messiah as he actually exists, as depicted in the Bible for those who, like myself, accept its teaching authority. These people don't care about the cross. The true totem of their faith is Nagin's bat. The battle cry of the American War for Independence was no king but King Jesus. The rally cry of Trump's followers is no Jesus, give us a king. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and at thelibertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, doom spirito pugno while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.
No dictator, no invader can hold an imprisoned population by force of arms forever. There is no greater power in the universe than the need for freedom. Against that power, governments and tyrants and armies cannot stand. Though it take 1,000 years, we will be free.